Hi everyone, this is Dr. Cheryl Selman and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me once again for another opportunity to have an in-depth conversation about a topic that is just so important and relevant for all of us. You've heard me say it many, many times, but the purpose of the show is really to empower you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. So I'm just so pleased that you are sharing this hour with me and my guests because it really will give you profound insight, and that's what it's all about. For those of you who may be joining me for the first time, I do want to invite you to go to my website, which is whatwomenmustknow.com, and also just hop over to my Facebook page, which is also What Women Must Know. I do a lot of posting and put additional information up there on my Facebook page. And the good thing is that all of my archive shows are also sent out to everyone on my list, on my e-list, on my Facebook page. So it provides you a way to make sure you're getting all of these shows and all of the great information, all the wonderful experts that I'm bringing to you every week. So, so if you haven't already opted in, please do so. Lots of gifts waiting for you and all sorts of things that I continue to share throughout the day. And let's talk about the topic at hand. For those of you who have been listening to me for quite a while, and, you know, I think about it, and it's about 12 years that I've been doing this radio show, so it's a great opportunity for me to meet fantastic people. I get inspired. I get educated along with you. And one of the topics that I have been really passionate about and personally investigating, researching, and lecturing about has been the whole EMF, cell phone, Wi-Fi world we're in. And as you may know, I've had many guests on my show, many researchers, many authors, many scientists who are giving us the latest information that we really must know. So today we're going to continue on this educational journey of learning about the dangers of EMFs. And my guest today, Peter Sullivan, is an expert and passionate about talking in regards to the EMF, autism, ADHD, whole neurological impact from this technology in our children. And I think it extends to us as well. So let me just share a little bit about Peter before we jump into our conversation. Peter Sullivan is the founder and CEO of Clear Light Ventures Incorporated, as well as an environmental health funder who focuses on toxins and wireless safety. He has spent the last 15 years successfully recovering his two sons from autism and sensory issues. Peter's work on detoxification and EMF have been featured in the book Toxin, Tox Out, Getting Harmful Chemicals Out of Our Bodies and Our World. The book The Out of Sync Child Grows Up, Coping with Sensory Processing Disorder in the Adolescent and Adult Years, and CNN's Martin Spurlock, Inside Man. He serves on the board of directors of Pure Earth and on the advisory board for the International Institute for Building Biology and Ecology. He speaks about autism and environmental health at conferences throughout the United States and abroad. So it is my great pleasure to welcome Peter Sullivan to the show today. So hello and welcome, Peter.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I just want to thank you for your passion and commitment in helping to educate and empower people on this subject. I know it's really near and dear to you, and you're doing great work out there as you lecture all over the world and help people to understand what's really going on. So thanks for all the wonderful work you're doing.
No problem.
So, Peter, you started this from a very personal place, I gather, with your two sons. Can you talk a little bit about what happened to them and how their experiences led you into this passion of yours?
Yeah, so my wife and I are both here in Silicon Valley in Northern California. We live in Los Altos, right near Palo Alto. And we had kids, we had two boys, one in 1996 and one in 1999. And right in the middle of the internet bubble where everything was kind of going wild. So we're both working and doing all kinds of stuff. And I think the thing that finally got us into this is the inciting incident was I came home from work one day and got the download that my son had been kicked out of preschool, my oldest, and for just not behaving well and, you know, or just kind of getting too triggered and upsetting other kids. And they asked him to get, you know, they said, we don't want him to come back and we'd like him to get a diagnosis. And it took the wind out of my sails. I literally dropped to my knees when I got the news because I was a psychology major in undergrad. My dad's a psychiatrist. I didn't expect any of this at all. I always expect to be helping other people and not on the needing help side. So we took our son in, got him diagnosed, and it was a sensory integration was the original diagnosis, which was some people consider it part of the autism spectrum. Some people consider it separate. It's definitely a symptom that almost all autistics have, being like over or under sensitive to a wide range of sensory input. So he had fairly, you know, his socialization was good and other things. So generally this was their diagnosis. So I, you know, worked on just the sensory stuff for years and then finally started looking at biological stuff and worked on top, you know, kind of, we all kind of progress for whatever, you know, diseases and states. You kind of sometimes you start with the genetics, maybe you think, oh, it's genetic, you know, and then you start looking at the diet and the biological stuff and supplements and toxins. And then eventually we kind of worked into, after years and years and years, looked at wireless and other EMF sources. And it took, in being in Silicon Valley, it took us a long time to process that input. Like, you know, the seeds were planted, but it wasn't quite registering because, you know, we're part of this whole situation. I love technology. I was a software designer. Some of the people who did the hardware are friends of mine. So it was really hard to kind of turn the corner on this. It was kind of like being in Texas and you know, changing your mind on global warming and accepting it. So definitely years of processing to change my mind about this. But I'm still really fundamentally about empowering people, especially children. And my original goal was to empower people with personal technology. Now I empower people mostly by getting them away from technology. But mm-hmm. I think I'm hopeful in the future that we can make safer technology. But of course, sadly, it was not just my oldest son who started having issues. My second son had a similar regression, and his symptoms were more antisocial. He kind of went offline socially. And then I actually had some health problems as well. I started getting really fatigued and not sleeping well. And so we went through a host of issues, and it turned out, certainly wireless was not the entire solution, but it was the part that if I was going to go back and do it again, it was the part that I would do first. And I think that's the tricky part.
Yeah.
Because mentally it's the part that you will get to last. You know, I probably took me 8 years to even start considering it, and maybe 10 years before I really was like, oh, right? And now it's the number one thing you do. And the wonderful thing about it is, unlike diet and toxins, you can have some really immediate impacts by turning things off, especially at night. So that's my advice, having kind of gone through the journey, is to start with this. And just the awareness alone can be half the battle, if not more.
So can you define what sensory processing disorder means? Because I've seen that term a lot, and I know people whose children have had that diagnosis, but in all honesty, I don't really know what it means.
Okay. Usually, and I think it's about 30% of the population has some sort of sensing difference where they're oversensitive or undersensitive to some stimulus. And about 10%, it kind of gets serious where it's really, it's hard, it's overwhelming. And I think for me, I felt like I was getting bothered by a lot of like loud noises, like, you know, a lot of computer noises and fans. Noise was really aggravating me when I was in the same era that the kids were going through this. And so I just assumed that I was sensitive to noise. And I didn't like scratchy pants or certain materials and that sort of thing. So I was pretty sensitive to touch and hearing, and my son was almost exactly the same. Now, in retrospect, a lot of that is related to wireless. But from a sensory perspective, you'll see probably there's a popular book about sensitive people right now. I can't think it's one of the popular books on Amazon. I can't remember the exact one. So a lot of people, you know, probably a third of your audience will be, you know, sensitive to something. And so I think his book is called like Highly Sensitive People or something like that. And that starts to get into sensory processing about feeling just kind of overloaded and out of sync when you get overwhelmed with certain sensory input. Does that make
sense?
So
did you – yes, it does. It does, exactly. So did you have a lot of – since you were a software designer in Silicon Valley, I mean, did you surround yourself by a lot of technology and Wi-Fi? And I mean, you know, even 10 years ago, it wasn't as pervasive as it is now, but I guess you still – there was a lot going on. Do you think that your environment from your work and what you brought home was part of – the contributing factor to your sons and even to yourself?
Oh, of course, yeah. Now, the interesting thing was that here in Silicon Valley, I had products that were out, you know, before they were even out. I have them in my house, or the day they're out, I have them, right? So I had Wi-Fi in our house in the late 90s where most people didn't have it. You know, I basically had exposures. The exposures that people are getting now, I had like 10 years ago. So I had – so I get to
you
be –
You had all the toys.
I had all the toys, and, you know, the iPhone designer was a friend of mine and came over to the house. I mean, this is, you know, another one of the phone designers was a friend in grad school. So, and so I had all the toys, and, yeah, definitely. And I was pushing them all on my kids. I had a little robot computer, you know, I had my kids on the computer constantly and all kinds of things. And, yeah, I had Wi-Fi way before other folks and, you know, always had the latest cordless phone and, you know, that sort of thing, and then cell phones, et cetera. So, and I had a smartphone way before other people. I think I had, let's see, when did I have a start? Maybe 2001 or something. I had one of the Trios before, you know, became a So basically the Palm Pilot, I don't know if you remember that, the nerdy. So I had the Palm Pilot the very first day it came out. In 1997, I think, and then that eventually became a smartphone, one of the very first smartphones. So I think I had that in my pocket since like 2001 or so, and then, you know, got an iPhone in about 2008 or so. And so most people really didn't have smartphones, and most people haven't had smartphones until 2008 or 10 or something like that. And so, you know, earlier exposure, but you know, the lesson is that. You know, now I know how to modulate the exposures, and I've had more time to – I've had 10 years to process the information. And you see people now going through what I went through with the sleep disruption and the ear ringing and just getting kind of – losing emotional control and all these things, the symptoms, and you just go, well, you know where that's going because you've lived it, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And it's sad when go ahead.
I was just going to say you were like the canary in the coal mine.
Exactly. That's, you know, they call the in Silicon Valley, it's the, you know, you say it's the cutting edge, but it's often called, you know, the bleeding edge for a reason. You know, it can go well or it can go wrong. And so this technology, it's, you know, maybe think of it like the early automobiles. You know, they work great. We love the functionality, but they're not terribly safe. And we need to make safety a market requirement, just like it was for automobiles.
You know, I think maybe it was on one of the blogs I read on your website, which I encourage people to go visit, clearlightventures.com, with Dr. Klinghart, who Dr. Dietrich Klinghart is well known for treating children with autism, and his office is quite close to Microsoft, and I think this is on one of your blogs, right? So he was treating so many of the employees from Microsoft. Their children were being diagnosed with autism, and he began to see this connection between exposure to electromagnetic radiation and higher incidence of autism as well. So there's, you know, this growing awareness. How did you realize, what made you realize that this electromagnetic radiation component was such a factor in what was happening to your family?
I've been working with Cure Autism Now, and giving them, you know, giving funding them. and meeting with one of their chief science officers, and she would give me, Sophia Colomarino would brief me, you know, every couple of months or so on what was going on. And I remember her just saying, you know, we haven't found a single gene. They kind of people expected it to be one gene. Well, it wasn't one gene. And then they found all these multiple genes. She says, well, we're going to find along similar pathways. There's going to be some commonality. She said, look out for the calcium channel. She said, you know, we keep seeing multiple genes along this pathway or in that same area. She said, she thought that was a big suspect. And so when I went to an event out here in San Francisco at the San Francisco Commonwealth Club, it was the first time I had heard scientists talking about wireless stuff in 2010. And someone said, you know, they were talking about people who are electrosensitive and who are very sensitive to electrical for wireless and so forth. And they said, right now it's about 1 in 100 people. And they started talking about calcium influx and efflux, which is calcium going in and out of the cells and, you know, and dysregulation of that. And I remember the calcium channel comment from Sophia and also the concept that maybe 1 in 100 people were electrosensitive. I thought, that kind of matches, that's about the same rate as autism. You know, is this, you know, one of the things going on that you're set up by some genetic factor, like a calcium channel variation, and then the environmental factor overloads it, which is what most people kind of think is going on. It's this combination of genetic factors and environmental exposures, both chemical and now including EMF. So that was when the light really turned on. And so it's an interesting story. Because I had lived the experience, I'd already kind of started learning that my exposures were reducing exposure made me feel good and made me feel better. And my body knew that it was a problem, but my brain hadn't seen all the research and everything yet. And so it was kind of putting it all together. I searched on PubMed for autism and EMF, and I found one paper. And so I called the researcher up, Dr. George Carlo.
George.
Yeah, exactly. So George and I talked, and he starts going into, he gives me this incredibly detailed description of autism, and he says, I call it more like hypermembrane sensitivity, and it's from this exposure and this, you know, from, you know, genetics and chemical exposures, and he was looking at heavy metals and you know, wireless and EMF. And I my brain was blowing up. I said, no one in the autism world knows about this. I've been in the autism world for about, you know, at that time, maybe about 6 years, and, you know, had never heard anybody talk about this level of detail and the mechanisms. And I said, well, how did you learn about this? He says, I used to run cell phone safety testing in the 90s. And that's when I almost died, right? And, you know, I was like, oh, my God. I helped connect Cindy Sage, who was an EMF researcher with the Bio Initiative, with Martha Herbert, who is an autism researcher that I had known from Cure Autism Now and works at Harvard. And those two together wrote a paper basically saying, well, the known symptoms of autism match the known symptoms of EMF exposure. And that paper is, if you search for EMF and autism, you'll find that in PubMed under, like, Martha Herbert is the author and Cindy Sage. I think it's a plausibility of EMF and autism. I think it's like plausibility of a pathophysiological link or something like that. It's a long paper, and it really had, the original version had 550 citations, so it's not a not for the faint of heart. It's pretty strong evidence. It doesn't mean there's a direct link yet, but at least it's incredibly suspicious. And then when you combine that with the people like Dr. Klinghardt and other doctors who are reducing exposure and seeing dramatic impacts with the children right away, you know, I think it would be very difficult to prove that there would be no link at this point.
So what do you think actually happens? How does exposure to these electromagnetic fields from all our wireless devices, from the cell phone towers, I think, you know, we can go through the litany of exposures now, from smart meters to, you know, baby monitors to Bluetooth in cars to, you know, just, you know, the echo that's in people's homes now. I mean,
exactly.
The list grows long, and I'm sure you've had so many of those toys. But what's the explanation of exposure to these fields and how it impacts, is it neurological functioning? Is it what's happening to the inflammatory response in the body? Is it happening in the gut? What's your understanding of the mechanism leading to autism?
You know, I'll give you some kind of shared wisdom from Dr. Herbert and Martin Paul. So Dr. Herbert likes to think of it as a state of overload. So it's not just a brain problem, but it's a state of overload through the whole body from multiple factors. So, you know, chemical exposures, lower food quality, EMF exposures, et cetera. Martin Paul will get very specific on it, and he will say basically that he believes that it's caused by a combination of wireless and chemicals, mostly acting in the calcium channel. That wireless acts at the calcium channel and keeps the calcium channel open too long. So too much calcium gets in and causes inflammation, free radical damage, elevation of nitric oxide. I'm not great with the mechanism there, but I just think of it as inflammatory overload.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks that the chemicals are really working through the NMDA receptors. Now, that we've also just found recently, looking at details of the calcium channel, that there is a MIDAS, which is called a metal ion dependent something sensor, on the outside of the calcium channel. So we think that the metal ions, whether they be toxic metals or regular metals, are tuning up and down the calcium channels and lowering, because those gateways, the calcium channel is basically voltage regulated. So it's, I'm trying to think how to explain this. It's kind of like the spring door on a spring door that has a spring on it, and a screen door that has a spring on it that kind of flops open and closed. And if the spring can be tight or can be loose. So some people have a looser spring, and the door stays open too long, and too much calcium gets in, right? So it gets kind of floppy. And that's kind of what's going on with what some of the doctors will say, that it's really kind of like an excitotoxicity issue, where things get overexcited, overinflamed. And then it just – that's when you and I think from an experiential perspective, we talked about sensory overload. If you think of inflammation if you think of autism as a state of overload, and you say, well, it's being overloaded, and you say, well, primarily let's think of it as inflammation, although there's other factors as well, you've probably had the experience of being hungover or having a concussion or being in some state where you've become really you wake up the next day after a hangover or something, and you're very sensitive to light and noise and that sort of thing. So that gives you that sensory overload state that these folks are in. And you know that when you're in those states, it's not a great time to be social. You're not learning. You just kind of want to hang by yourself. And I think that's a nice analogy. And so if we can lower these exposures and lower inflammation in the body, the kids can get out of this state of overload and get back on track.
And you know what else happens, and I recently had Dr. Martin Paul on my radio show. He's always inspiring to me.
Mm-hmm.
But he brought up the fact that when you have exposure to EMFs, there are a lot of these physiological changes going on, including opening up and having greater access to the blood-brain barrier. So
exactly.
Chemicals get in, right, and heavy metals
right.
get into the brain. And,
right.
And also the other fascinating thing from the research I've done, that exposure to EMFs will kind of activate molds and viruses and the Lyme spirochete and biotoxins. They all kind of get
exactly.
enhanced, strengthened, or because they feel these frequencies and kind of react as a protective mechanism and get stronger. So these are all the dynamics that lead to chronic illnesses and certainly to autism. So this is where the EMF story is so profound, because I think, you have found this as well. It's such an underpinning of all the chronic health
exactly.
challenges our society is facing right now. Do you want to share a little bit more about that from your perspective?
Yeah, I will. So when I speak on this at the autism conference, I usually say that, you know, this is a piece of the puzzle. It's not, again, like we said, it's not the whole thing, but it's tied in and with all these other things. And so you have a genetic piece, you have this chemical piece, you have the physiology, right? So if you've got low vitamin D, or if you've, you know, low melatonin or whatever, these things can all, you know, reduce your immune system. And then you've got these chemical exposures and then these infectious agents. But then there's this, also this thing that I started learning about when I was learning about toxins, is that your body has gears, like, you know, like a car. You know, your body can be in fight or flight mode, or it can be rest, digest, grow mode. And if your body gets stuck in fight or flight mode by some agent like EMF that will trigger you, overstimulate you, and get you kind of overexcited, you are not resting and digesting and detoxing. So it means the toxins build up, and again, as you said, the pathogens in the gut, even the healthy gut flora, might be triggered, right, by this whole situation. So so I think that people have to understand the fight or flight mode too, that you really, fight or flight mode is meant to be, you're made to be in it for a couple minutes and then get out. You're not meant to live in it for days and years. And when you're in fight or flight mode constantly, you're not in a sustainable state, right? You're not in a place that's going to go on forever. You're not cleaning up. Like I like to say, if someone's chasing you around with a knife in the kitchen, you don't stop and do the dishes. So you're not going to be detoxing. All of these things, there's all this cleanup activity is not a priority, nor is like maintenance or building, you know, connecting neurons or whatever. It's like, we need to stay alive today. And if your body thinks that it's really threatened like that, all of these things get deferred. I would also link the blood-brain. Yeah, the blood-brain barrier thing I think is a key point, because it changes people's perspective, and they'll say like, well, we've had all these chemical exposures for years. And you say, but those chemicals haven't been rising. Correct. Some of them have not been rising. But when you open the blood-brain barrier, now these chemicals are now have access to neural tissue that they didn't have access to before. And the blood-brain barrier mechanism is similar to the gut barrier mechanism. And some doctors will say that if the blood-brain barrier is breached, the gut is also breached, and vice versa. So key elements. And it's hard to, you know, people want there to be a single solution, and it's pretty complex. You really do have to check through all the boxes and kind of really clean up a wide range of things to really get out of this kind of environmental illness thing that we've got going on right now.
Which is only getting worse, and just more connectivity creates more constant exposure. And the worrying thing is that research, at least that I've been finding, is that the ovarian follicles in a pregnant woman, or even women don't even have to be pregnant, the ovarian follicles, those little immature eggs, can be altered. Their DNA can actually be altered by exposure to EMFs. So
right.
We're creating potential damage to our DNA either in the fetus or even before conception, which then shows up in future generations or in our children, and what will happen
right.
down the track is a concern, right?
Yeah, exactly. Actually, we're with autism, we actually have in these mutations called de novo mutations. I don't know if you've heard of those, but it means it's like an uninherited mutation, which you just talked. Basically, my genes didn't make it to my kids. Something got flipped.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what we found in autism is that the most of the mutations actually come from the man's side. That the women, you know, women have their eggs throughout their lifetime, whereas men are constantly creating these new spermicides or whatever. And so for some reason, that makes them more prone to genetic damage because they're reproducing constantly and changing, and that's when the DNA is most sensitive. So we are looking specifically for environmental factors that would be damaging sperm in men. Obviously one of the big factors we're very concerned about is cell phone in the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to
Absolutely.
Conception.
Yeah.
And that, as like you said, so if you flip if you damage a gene, and then it goes forward not only to your child, but to every child forward. I mean, I don't even know how to account for that financially or emotionally. That's just really disastrous. And that's, you know, going on right now rampantly.
Yeah, you know, this new network that is being rolled out, known as 5G, fifth generation, where I maybe you can explain it to my listeners so they can really appreciate what we're about to be encountering worldwide, actually.
Okay. Well, 5G, the G stands for generation. So it's there's been first generation, second generation. I think most people maybe know the term 3G. They sometimes see that on their phone. And 4G is the fourth generation is LTE. So if they see LTE on their phone, that stands for long-term evolution, and that's fourth generation technology. So the fifth generation technology is higher frequency and up in the gigahertz range. I'm not super expert on this. I know there's more people following this and doing all the research on this. But basically, instead of having cell towers, the higher the frequency, the faster the bandwidth, but also higher frequencies can't really go through walls as well. So they're looking at having some of these things all over the place, like, you know, one on every block, which is pretty intense right now. You don't want to be too close to a cell tower for health reasons, and now they're going to be putting one on every block potentially. And you may not even have the ability to demonstrate or try to stop it in any way. So the only positive thing with 5G is that it does not go through walls. So if they end up installing it, which they actually have it, they're testing it right now in Palo Alto, in downtown Palo Alto, and in Mountain View, I believe. And so I've been through those areas, and we had some of the folks go through and test it and look at the levels. Myself being fairly sensitive to stuff, I haven't gone down to that area too much and hung around there. But apparently the higher frequencies don't penetrate the body as deeply, but they can be pretty rough on the skin and eyes. And those would be the ones that would be most problematic. And so it's a concern. It's a real concern for people who are electrosensitive, who have become really overloaded by this stuff and can't really be around it without being very symptomatic, that they are they don't have any place to go.
That's
issue.
It. There's no safe spaces anymore. I mean, the statistic I've heard is somewhere between 20-30% of the population now is electrosensitive. So that's only going to get worse as we get, I know with the 5G, it's like expanding the bandwidth is expanding. It's like the way I explain it, and correct me if this is a good metaphor, it's like imagine your FM station, and you've got between 88 or 85 to 105 on the dial, and every time you move your dial, it's a different frequency within that range, and that lets you get a different station. So the 5G, I think, is going to imagine you had that range from that FM range, but it's going to be multiplied like 1,000 times, 1,000
exactly.
more. Is that an accurate metaphor?
Exactly. And what people need to know is that the higher the frequency, the higher energy. And higher energy is from an information perspective better because you can send more information, but higher energy can have greater impact, right? Energy is always, sounds like it's a good thing, but in this case, it's disruptive and imbalancing, and it'll be a little bit harsher. So we'll see, and it's interesting, there'll be different effects, it's concerning. What we learned last year, which was interesting at the autism conference, you were saying that about 20 or 30% of people are electrosensitive. And so I've heard some people say, different percentages. It depends on how you define electrosensitive, it's still kind of vague at this point. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of curious. I'm calling you right now from a wireless free room. So I have a shielded room in my office here. I have multiple shielded rooms, and I've had this for about 7 years now. And I've been able to take people up here and give them demonstrations of turning things on and off. And I was usually able to get about 50% of people to feel some effect. Whether it's turning something off or turning something on, they could feel. Some people would feel wireless, some people would feel magnetic fields, whatever. So when we went to the autism conference last year, two years ago actually, we Martin, Paul, and I both felt like there was the wireless levels were really high, and neither of us felt great there. So last year we built a wireless-free zone, and it was a bit challenging. We basically ended up taking an event tent and covering it with shielding material, and we got the Wi-Fi level. The Wi-Fi level was about 3,000 to 5,000 microwatts, which is about three times the extreme concern level from a building biology perspective. And then the average level, though, inside the tent, we were able to get it down to zero, which is amazing. So when you walked, when you went in, I could go outside the tent and then go inside, and I could feel much better as soon as I walked in. And so I was thinking to myself, I'm hoping maybe 50, 60% of people will be able to feel some sort of effect. Well, it turns out that almost everyone was able to feel an effect. It was maybe about 3 to 5% of people who did not feel an effect. And most people felt better in their head. They felt calmer immediately. And so a lot of people right now who are in the audience and not sleeping well and they're feeling agitated, they just don't feel right, a lot of times it's just straight up, it's not about them, it's really the environment that they're in. And if they can get to an environment that's safe or start turning things off at night or they go out to nature, it really, really makes a difference. And that was something that happened to me about mid-2000s. I was not sleeping well. I was feeling stressed and really kind of feeling anxious and not feeling great. And I kind of realized at some point, I feel great in nature, but then I go back to, that it was pretty clear it wasn't me. It was the environment. But it took a while to kind of figure that out. And you need those discerning, you need to see that black and white distinction so your nervous system can kind of go like, oh, I feel good here, I don't feel good here. And when your nervous system can see those distinctions, then you can learn and kind of tune into to how these things feel.
And everybody feels a challenge.
Different.
And that's a challenge, Peter, isn't it? Because how many opportunities do people get to enter a Wi-Fi free space? So we don't have the ability to make those distinctions at all. I have a friend in Tennessee, and she works with kids with autism and learning disabilities and people with chronic illnesses, and she's created a Wi-Fi free space in her clinic, and she just sees immediate changes in the children as soon as they walk into her office.
That's what we learned last year, is that we had adults coming in, but then we had some of these kids who were really, I don't know if you know the word stimming, but these kids get hyperactive and they kind of start flapping their hands and kind of walking around on their toes because they're just really, really locked up in fight or flight mode. And they're trying to kind of work off the energy and everything is spinning and doing all kinds of things. Well, some of these kids walked in and started to calm down. One of them went from being stimming like that to just right on the floor sleeping. So their body his body just shifted into sympathetic or parasympathetic nervous system and just was like, oh, finally, plop. And so, again, that's one of the key steps is they have to be, what I tell these folks is number one is you have to be in a safe environment, and then your body has to think it's safe. So your body has to calm down enough. And some of these kids it's almost like a circuit breaker. They're just locked. They're so locked up in fight or flight mode that they need a little bit of help kind of nudging out of it with, different therapies, sometimes like cranial sacral work or a little bit of chiropractic can kind of pop them back into a place where their parasympathetic nervous system is back online again.
So, Peter, what are your suggestions to help people reduce exposure to this ever-growing EMF environment that we have just embraced so enthusiastically, mind you, without any proper research investigation, or actually there is lots of research, but it's being ignored.
Exactly.
To be honest,
Yeah.
What are some of your favorite strategies that you use?
We have a protocol. We have a free protocol that was developed by a doctor out here. Dr. Yelter and Cindy Sage developed this protocol. I was trying to build these. I thought, well, we're going to have to build these shielded rooms and everything, and that was expensive. And they came up with a really creative protocol, which is to start just in unplugging some things at night. So unplugging some constant exposures just at night. And this was started with children who had ADHD and autism. And the results can be pretty profound. So, matter of fact, I'll tell you what the protocol is, and I'll tell you one of the benefits of it, one of the stories, which is amazing. So you turn off, if you have a baby monitor, you turn that off at night. You unplug your Wi-Fi router or your cordless phone base station. Those are your main sources of wireless exposure. And, of course, if you have a cell phone, you don't really want it in your bedroom, and ideally maybe in airplane mode. And then for some of these people, because wireless can also be, there can be electrical interference on the wiring itself, they'll turn the circuit breaker off on the bedroom, so on the outlets and maybe on the light above if they're separate outlets. So that's the whole protocol. You know, if you just start with the wireless stuff, you'll have a good chunk of it. Now, so that's obviously a free protocol that you can do. And what happened with one of Dr. Yelter's patients, they had as a nonverbal autistic boy who had never spoken. And after 3 days on this protocol, he blurted out a full sentence.
Hmm.
And he was shocked, and the mother was shocked.
Hmm. Hmm.
And I've had a similar – so then I had a similar experience where I had a 20-year-old boy. I met a woman in Texas who had a child on the spectrum, and the boy was 20 years old. So a lot of people feel like as the kids are older, there's nothing they can do. It's just that's the way it is. So I told her about this protocol, and she only turned off the Wi-Fi. So she turned off the Wi-Fi one night. The next day, the therapist came in to work with the child and said to the mom, "What did you do? This kid, he's on task, he's focused. What did you change?" She goes, "The only thing I changed was I unplugged the router at night." So it's your
wow.
Nighttime exposure is such a key place, such a key time for your brain to clean out and to recharge your body and build up melatonin and all these things, that if you are interrupting it and not allowing it to really go deeply, it can really overload people. So that's simple. Now, we have these cards on our website. We've been giving away these cards at different events, and it's clearlightventures.com/wirelesscard. And we kind of go through some of the protocols we just talked about. So we talked about the baby monitor, Wi-Fi router, your cordless phone, your cell phone, your laptop, iPads and tablets, smart meters, and cell towers. And then on the website, I go into even some more detail on, alarm systems and other things. But we're kind of using this as a checklist to create space around ourselves and our children, especially at night. So, go into your bedroom. You really want kind of an electronic-free zone in the bedroom to create a little, cocoon around your body that is electronic-free, and you're out of danger from these things. Because what's remarkable is that you can unplug things. That's easy. It turns them off. But every time you double the distance, so if a baby monitor is 4 feet away and you make it 8 feet away, the exposure level goes down 75%. So,
right.
And then likewise, if you move it closer, if you have the distance, let's say it's 1 foot away and you make it six inches away, the exposure is now four times higher, which is really concerning when you talk about cell phone next to the head, because no one, even the cell phone manufacturers, tell you you're not supposed to have it right next to your body. They usually say it's like half an inch or so forth. So there's a website called Show the Fine Print that will tell you for your cell phone how far it's actually supposed to be, how far it's tested to be away from your body. And I would say that even the FCC testing limit is not really safe. It's not adequate.
I've seen statistics that say your phone emits a field 10 to 15 feet out. So,
well, you can measure it. Yeah, you can measure it quite a ways, and it depends on the phone and what's going on. And what people don't know is, what people really don't know is that when it's not being used, it's still updating with the smartphones. So you can have a phone sitting next to you that you're not using, and you're getting hit by the signal, or if it's in your pocket or so forth. So I frequently use, for cell phones, we use airplane mode, but even with airplane mode, you want to turn the Wi-Fi and the Bluetooth off.
Mm-hmm.
And use those things sparingly. And I tend not to keep it in my pocket anymore. I'll tend to put it in a backpack. And again, most of the time for me, I have it in airplane mode. But there are varying levels and strategies for the cell phone, depending on how frequently, how much contact you need to be in and what needs to be updated and so forth. There's ways of shielding one side of it. Like you put it in a backpack or a purse that has one side shielded that gives you a little bit of buffer towards your body. There's quite a bit of strategies in turning off some of the updating, etc. But definitely don't put it next to the head, or don't carry it in the pocket or the bra. If you could kind of put it in a purse or a backpack and give it some distance, that would be really helpful.
So, Peter, what are your thoughts about smart meters? Because they are being rolled out all over the world, and they are attached to the side of our homes. Some people I know, it's attached to their bedroom walls, the outside of their bedroom walls, and, you know, in other places, you know, it's different parts of the home. But what is your recommendation to
people? If you can opt out. So there are two problems with smart meters. One is the wireless radiation, which usually bursts out every about 6 seconds or so in strong pulses. Now, but there are varying degrees of smart meters, like, you know, from different companies, and some of them are really, really harsh, and some of them are actually not too bad, like not your primary concern. But it's hard to tell unless you've got a meter and you're really measuring that. So generally, opting out is good. And there's two issues, too. It's not just the wireless signals coming off of that meter. There are, of course, there's signals coming off your neighbors and everything. But there's also dirty electricity. There's also like little electrical transients that are generated by the smart meter itself, by the what they call a switching power supply in the smart meter. And that makes your electricity a little bit harsher. And so if you've ever been in a building with kind of buzzing lights and things feel kind of harsh, the refrigerator sounds kind of harsh and the music sounds weird, you know, a little bit muffled, that you're in an environment that has, you know, a lot of dirty electricity. That's a book by Sam Milham that he kind of coined that term. So there's two issues with it. I think the best thing is to opt out of it. If you can't opt out of it, it's more complex. You can potentially shield it so that it doesn't, you know, come into your living environment so much of the radiation that way. And then you'd also have to do some work to reduce dirty electricity with some of these filters or other mechanisms for reducing dirty electrical noise.
Now, I've seen various Faraday cages, which are these metal cages that go around the smart meter itself and then locks in to at the back of it, which supposedly can reduce up to 95% of what is emitted.
Exactly.
Do you think they're effective?
Some of those are, yeah, pardon?
Do you think they're effective?
Well, yeah, I think that they do reduce the emission. It depends on how sensitive you are. So Less EMF sells some of those. And, of course, the website Take Back Your Power has a lot of those solutions. Mm-hmm. So that's a film, a documentary about smart meters, about lots of factors on smart meters, not just health but privacy and other things. So I would definitely recommend the Take Back Your Power website for a lot of details on individual smart meters. They'll tell you which smart meters are bad and how bad they are and how much they emit and so forth. So, but yeah, those things can work. Again, if you can opt out, great. I think that's even better. It's just tricky in certain situations, you know, and people have to make a call whether they opt out or whether they try shielding or whether it may, in some cases, it may not be. My dad has a smart meter down in Palm Desert, and it doesn't measure as being that harsh. And that's kind of what I've heard from some of the building biologists, is that at least in California, that Northern California meters were harder to start, were harsher, the PG&E meters, than the Southern California meters. And it turns out also they've said that they've dialed them down a little bit too. So they've kind of learned that it doesn't serve them in any way to have them up this high, that they're just getting complaints. And I'm hearing too that they're saying now that PG&E says that they won't allow builders to install the smart meters, the power meter outside a bedroom anymore, because they've had so many issues with this. So we'll see how that all shakes out, and it is rolling out for a lot of folks. And if you can say no, I know it's kind of hard to stand up and do that sort of stuff, but I think that's the best option in the long term.
And you have to say no before they install it.
Once they install it, it's really hard to undo. You can undo.
It is here anyway.
It is there. I think it depends.
Yeah,
obviously from the beginning that's great, but if you know, I think you always have an option. You should, in theory, you should always have an option. You are a consumer with rights.
Well, I can tell you it's not an option here.
It's getting some areas there is no opt out.
Yeah, no, people can opt out, but there is no option once it's on.
Really?
They won't take it off.
Okay.
So you got to be proactive. So one question I want to be sure to ask you, Peter. Let's go back to initially the in beginning of the interview about your two sons mm-hmm. who are having these symptoms, variations yeah. of an autistic or sensory processing issues. What did you do to help them recover?
We went through kind of a wide range of things. So we, first assumed it was genetic and did a lot of calming protocols and things like, auditory intervention therapy. So a lot of these kind of things that physical therapists will do with kids, there are all kinds of sensory books that you can read to calm their nervous systems and so forth. So I did that for a couple of years. And then we started doing biological stuff. I started playing around with diet and so avoiding, avoiding different dietary factors, allergens, so the wheat and dairy and artificial ingredients and MSG and these sort of excitotoxins, these sort of things. And then looking at enzymes and then finally going into toxins, so heavy metals and reducing metals in the body. So that was kind of the process, and then we went through and then finally did EMF as well and EMF reductions. And that was kind of the thing. But I would do it, obviously, I would do it completely opposite. Matter of fact, I might not even do chelation or detox because, in retrospect, if you get the body out of fight or flight mode, it may have the capacity to keep up with things on its own. So you could be a little bit more relaxed about that process. And what we've learned with, it's tricky, but you get more sensitive with the toxic metals in you. But if you chelate aggressively, you're pulling out also the positive minerals as well, so the coppers and the potassiums and all these things that keep things in balance. So I think especially, it depends. People can use their judgment and talk to their doctors about this, but I think I would start with wireless reduction first and make sure that the body, that there's no exposures, that the wireless exposures and the chemical exposures are minimized in the environment, and then calm the body down so it's out of fight or flight mode, and then see how things may naturally kind of melt away at that point without a lot of further intervention.
Well, so what I hear you saying is that you really believe that the electromagnetic radiation is a primary driver of these manifestations of imbalance, and by mitigating them, it actually will have one of the greatest effects in helping the body
right.
to recover.
Yes, so exactly right. Matter of fact, the talk I give at Autism One is called Wireless, a Key Piece of the Autism Puzzle. And I say it's a key piece because, number one, we talked about there's all these different pieces of the puzzle. We talked about genetics, and, if wireless can damage genetics, okay, well, there's a problem right there. If wireless can interrupt physiology with calcium channel and reduce melatonin and so forth, that's a problem. If wireless can put the body in fight or flight mode, then that can impair detox, right? So these things are all kind of linked together, and it's one of the, I would say it's a foundational piece that has to be dealt with. And Dr. Klinghardt says this too. He says, if you don't remove the wireless piece, it's really hard to recover. Mm-hmm. And he sees it as kind of a, he sees autism as primarily, the primary drivers as being wireless, mercury and Lyme. And, a lot of people who just focus on the mercury or just focus on, diet or whatever, they have some impact, they have some success, but it's much, much harder if you're trying to overcome the wireless signals. So what Dr. Klinghardt did, a very simple pilot study on EMF, he found that he looked at the kids who had autism versus the kids who did not, and he found that the wireless levels were 20 times higher in the bedrooms and in the sleep compartments of the children who were having developmental delays than standard kids, and he found that the electric field levels were 8 times higher. And again, both of those are measured in volts, can be measured in volts per meter, and when you think about, yeah. The voltage-gated calcium channels, it's kind of like pounding on the door more heavily, and the door flies open. It's like the wind is blowing heavily and the screen door flies open. So when you lower the wind level or whatever, the pressure of these fields, then you can, keep up a little bit better.
Well, I knew of that study, but I didn't hear that statistic. Up to 20 times greater
20, actually, and it's really interesting because they're non-overlapping data sets. So it's kind of like here's, you know, this group and not. And what's interesting is that the levels line up with the levels that building biologists use. So if you can stay out of the extreme and severe levels, you know, then your kids should be in good shape. So I think it's a good measure that the building biology levels, which are based on, you know, biological research, are a little bit better than, clearly much better than what the FCC has got.
Well, you know, I get really concerned. I've been looking at some of the devices that are coming out. We talked about baby monitors, and I just advise people do not ever use a Wi-Fi baby monitor at all.
Right.
Use some intercom system, do something. But there are devices like a Wi-Fi pacifier. So on the parent's phone, they can measure the baby's temperature. And there's another device that I found that's you put it around the baby's ankle. So it looks like a little heart, cute little heart. But it can also monitor all these physiological processes that are going on in the infant. You know, a Wi-Fi device attached to the baby's foot all the time.
Right.
You know, I mean, doesn't that drive you crazy?
You know, it's crazy because, you know, here in Silicon Valley, some of the main, you know, titans are really trying to work on health and, you know, extending people's lives and everything. And they want to extend life by 50% and prevent disease and all this stuff. And they have not clued into the fact that, you know, it's going to be interesting when they really clue in that this is when they actually read the research that's out there and published or use their own search technology to search for the research that this is harmful. And you know, a lot of people said, oh, well, they already know and so forth. I think the FCC folks know, the CTIA folks know, but a lot of the folks who are in some of these client companies really are, you know, they have good intentions. They just do not know, and they've been told that non-ionizing radiation can do no harm and that it can't break up a molecule. And, you know, that I mean, ionizing means it's strong enough to break up an atom. What people need to understand is that's not the only, you know, breaking up an atom. That's, you know, the life depends on electrons as well and electron flow, and microwaves are used to accelerate electrons. So there are major impacts, and we find that there's free radical damage, and you know, there's a lot of damage. And if you look at, there's about 24,000 studies on this right now on EMF portal that people can look through if they'd like. And when they hear people say, oh, there's no studies, there are a lot of studies. Go look through them. So what I would say is that I think that a lot of the folks do have good intentions. And when they are aware of it, I hope they will take action to just start reducing exposures. But on a positive note, a lot of these things are exposures that we buy and control, and our closest exposures will have the most impact, and we control those close exposures. No one's going to force something to come right in next to your head unless you put it there. So just from one positive perspective, you know, we can be responsible and go through our own homes and start kind of moving these things away from our bodies and creating a little bit more space for ourselves and our kids. So and I'm hoping that the awareness around this topic will change just like it did around like the gluten-free diet. Like no one was promoting that. It was just by word of mouth. And that when people started doing things and having success, they told their friends. And that sort of thing then can become a market requirement like it is now. In the future, this lower exposure, you know, safe wireless will be a market requirement and the levels will go down and there'll be different, hopefully, alternatives. Like some of these protocols using light that may be safer, may not, we'll see. But I think we can get there.
Well, I'm glad to hear you're optimistic, Peter. you know, I think it's great that we're having this conversation. People can get aware. People can take whatever steps they want to take. But there is a problem, and we do need to become cognizant of it and be proactive in our lives for the sake of our children. So I'm really grateful for the wonderful work that you're doing and spreading the word and really helping people to understand and also give them some strategies that supports them. So thank you. Thank you for that wonderful work that you're doing and really making a difference out there in the world.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's exciting.
It is exciting, and I want people to go visit your website because you have such great information. You have great blogs, and you've got the little guidance there for people. It's clearlightventures.com, right? Clearlightventures.com. So if people go over there and have a look and see what Peter is doing and the education that he's making available. In fact, please go over there because this is such an important topic and we need to get as enlightened and educated and empowered about this as we can be. So you're making such a contribution, Peter, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thank you very much.
And thank you all for listening. We've had this amazing conversation with Peter Sullivan. Visit his website, clearlightventures.com. Get empowered, get the knowledge so you can really take the steps to protect yourself and your family now and in the future. And remember, always remember to honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Thanks for joining me, and we'll be with you again next week. Take care now.